Welcome to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. My name is Lauren Wells, here with my co-host, Chris Seveny. We're committed to providing you with the knowledge required to build wealth through real estate investing. Tired of consuming content about real estate? Stuck in analysis paralysis? Ready to do your first deal? As a member of our community, you will learn how to go from consuming content to taking that first step into the world of real estate investing. Our show is not about getting rich quick, but about providing you with the knowledge you need to take action. Join us as we speak with experienced investors who share action tips on how to escape the corporate world, start a thriving side hustle in the world of real estate, and go beyond your W-2 or 401k. Welcome, everybody, to the Creating Wealth podcast, where each week we bring you education and information that will help you take your next step in building wealth through real estate. My name is Lauren Wells. I am your host. And today I am joined by the lovely Shanoa Groves. So welcome, Shanoa. So happy to have you.
Hey, Lauren. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So Shanoa is a fourth generation Texas real estate investor who started investing in 2003 and went full-time in 2004. She has done over 1,000 real estate deals, and as a result of her knowledge and success, she hasn't had to rely on taking a paycheck from anyone else since 2003. Shanoa joined her local real estate investing association in 2003 as well, and eventually purchased the association in 2008 and has grown it significantly since then. And as part of that, has helped train over 87,000 real estate investors on how to complete creative real estate transactions that work in every part of the market cycle. I was telling you, Shanoa, earlier, I don't feel like that does you enough justice. We met at Quest and you are a force and wants to gravitate towards you. And yeah, tell us a little bit about yourself. What got you started in real estate?
Yeah. So although I am a fourth generation real estate investor, I am of the age, and I'm sure most people who are listening here as well, the generation of people that said, I want you to go to college, right? I want you to go and pursue an advanced degree. I want you to go and get a job. So in spite of the fact that my great-grandparents invested, my grandparents invested, my parents still own over a dozen doors to this day, then in some cases they've had since the 90s, right? They encouraged me to go to school. And I thought, all right, I'm going to do this. And I'm going to show you guys how income is made and how wealth is made. And I'm going to show you how this stuff gets done. I was a redhead stepchild at that time in a way. And I finished my degree, finished my undergrad, got my MBA, and I started working in corporate America. And when I was in school, I jokingly referred to my mom as, this is my mom, the slumlord. And when I was in corporate America, I had to change the way that I introduced her to, this is my mom, the millionaire, actually the multimillionaire, as a result of what she did in real estate and real estate investing. And as I changed the way that I introduced her, there was this lump that just went down my throat, just swallowing a little bit of pride there of like, oh yeah, okay, they were right. But right about that time, my husband lost his job. So he got fired. And he had been in high tech for about 20 years, working at several different semiconductor companies and several different startups over the years as well. And he was looking at all different sorts of different businesses to be able to buy or to be able to start. And he really got hooked on investing in real estate. And he said to me, Shanoa, you're going to be coming along for the ride with me. And I'm like, hey, I think I might be good. Part of it was I had this identity as being in corporate America, had this identity of going and getting an education and being this person. And it was a little difficult for me to say that I was ready to exit that identity and exit corporate America and exit the blankie that was checking your account every 2 weeks, insurance, other benefits, et cetera. And I love to work, something I very much enjoy. As I got started, I was doing it on the side. And at some point I realized, wow, I'm making more money just doing this on the side than I am in my full-time job. And the company that I was with had barely survived dot-com boom and bust and was just by the fingernails. And I thought, oh, for sure, they've been firing like over half of the company. And I'm like, oh, for sure, they're going to fire me. So at least on the way out, I'll get a severance package. But I was like one of the ones that they were like, don't go, hang on, stay with us. And I'm like, I can't anymore. And I went full-time in 2004 And I've never had to update my resume since then. I haven't had to take a paycheck from anyone else since then. And it feels really fantastic as I'm going into, so in a couple of days, it'll be my 19th year anniversary. So I'm going into my 20th year, actually tomorrow. It's going to be kind
congrats.
Of exciting.
Early
it's
congrats.
Been, yeah, it's been a really fun and wonderful journey. And it has been one that's helped me create an incredible amount of income and wealth, which is one of the beautiful things about investing in real estate. And an incredible amount of freedom, both financial freedom, time freedom, which is probably the thing that I value most now. And something that I'm so glad that I exited from what I will call my identity at that time and haven't looked back since. And I'm so happy to do what I do. And I'll tell you, when I first started investing, it was all about money, right? So it's all about, I've got to create income. I've got to create wealth. I didn't have 401k anymore. And also wanted to live in really awesome, wonderful houses.
Yeah.
And at first I was just very singularly focused. And then I realized, wow, as I'm working with many of these people, I'm really being of service, being creative, using several different strategies to be able to buy and sell houses. For me, I know how to make money, whether a house has 100% equity or whether the house has little, no, or negative equity. So I basically, over the years, have figured out how to make money every single time the phone rings, which is one of the things that has kept me recession proof and has allowed me to not have to go up and redo my resume. So at this point in my life and my career, my resume is in some version of DOS that even the techies and the techie people couldn't resurrect. And I wouldn't want you to, because I love what I do in investing. And it went from creating income and wealth to, wow, I'm really helping a lot of people along this journey. And then it's also blossomed into training, coaching, mentoring. So not only do I get to help myself and help the people that I individually, that I buy and sell from, but I also get to help the people who I personally coach and we have our group coaches. What that looks like for me is watching them be successful is, oh, wow, this feels really fantastic and amazing. And then knowing that they're going out and touching lives as well, it just feels like life has come completely full circle. And now when people ask me what I do, right, for a living, I've got two things that I typically say that I do. Number one, when I'm buying, is I turn unrelenting, unwilling, unconvertible, unclosable homeowners into motivated sellers. And I do it all on unachievable timelines, all while solving unsolvable problems. And then as a real estate investor who also helps other people as they're getting started, I get to help people quit jobs that they hate so that they can do things that they love, enhance their own lives and the lives of others. And it feels amazing. And for me, it's just been part of my mission, part of my purpose to be able to touch those lives and just watch those tentacles grow out and affect the lives of others. And now for the students who work with me personally, I know that I've done my job when I get to collect their badge from when they log into work and they open a door into work. So I asked them, it's like, when you quit your job, I want your badge, because like my dream is to have a Christmas tree full of everyone's badges that I have helped quit their jobs, change their lives, spend time with people that they love when they want to do them. And the issue, the only problem I've encountered with doing that is that the first thing they ask you for when you leave your job is that badge. So either I'm going to have this dumpy, tiny little Charlie Brown style Christmas tree, or I'm just going to have to work harder and longer, and I'm in for the ride. It's been a blast for me. It's been incredibly rewarding for me and just really wonderful.
I love that. And I feel like that resonates a bit with me too. I'm the oldest of three girls. And whenever anyone asks about my real estate journey, it's the same. I was like, my family did real estate, but wanted me to go to college. And then I was like, I'm going to do my own thing. Like, I don't need to do what you're going to do. I'm going to make my own way. So I did like the tech, the corporate, Silicon Valley sales, that lived that life, only to look back at my younger sister who was like, I'm going to stick with real estate, and be like, wow, that was the smarter move. As you grow a family, as you realize your time is so valuable, I'm like, so much for being stubborn and oldest and all of that. So it resonates with me a little bit when to hear you say that kind of went through that journey. And you said something about how when you first started out, it was about making that income, because obviously you wanted to live and have your time and live in these houses. And what were some of your first investments? Like, what was your first deal?
As being a part of a family of real estate investors, what it was, when I was in college, my mom said to me, Shanoa, you can't rent. You've got to own, because we're a family of owners. We're not a family of renters. And from that standpoint, she was, okay, let's go find a house for you. And at the time, there was still a loan product called a non-qualifying assumable loan. So non-qualifying assumable loan is how a college kid with really no income to speak of. So at the time, and I don't want you to get jealous, Lauren, but at the time, I was making $4.75 an hour, American, right? I was 20. And so it didn't have really any savings. So the way that we bought that house is on a non-qualifying assumable loan. So they don't issue any of those loans anymore. They stopped issuing those in the 90s. And we bought that property in the early mid 90s. So now the way that we buy is we buy subject to. So it's similar process, maybe basically taking over someone's loan, but goes by a slightly different name, buying subject to. So for me, that was my first house that I got into. And then after that, I went to college. I was finished college and then I went back to get my MBA and then I was working in corporate America. So I basically put my real estate investing on hold. And it wasn't until I turned 30 that I got back into investing. And I'll tell you, that first house that my mom and I bought together is still in our family. So when we bought it, it was like we paid $105,000 for it. Today, it's easily worth somewhere between $1.6 and $1.8 million and it's still in our family. So that's a proof point to buy it and hold on no matter what happens, right?
Yeah.
So that was the first investment. And that was also part of what made me say, look back and say, am I creating as much wealth in my corporate career as I am in just this one investment that I dabbled in when I was in college? And after that, Phil and I started to invest together. I've bought houses to be moved. I have bought many houses subject to. I've wholesaled a lot of properties. I obviously keep a lot of rental properties because I know that is a foundation of wealth and building wealth, holding those over the long time. One of my coaches very on taught me that the people who make money, the people who get rich and build wealth in real estate are the ones that can afford to hold on to properties in between market cycles, right? So you have to have the capital to be able to hold on. And especially in a market like we're in right now, for those folks who are watching, who are just getting started, cash is king, right? It's like we're in this simultaneous era right now where on one hand, cash is trash because of inflation. And on the other hand, cash is king because of liquidity to be able to hold on to a product or a project in between market cycles, right? So that's one of the dances that we're having to do as real estate investors. We never want to be too cash rich and too equity poor or asset poor. And we never want to be too asset rich and too cash poor, right? There's always this balance. And that balance is the thing that's actually going to help you survive and thrive, no matter what the market throws at you. My career, it's like I've invested through multiple presidents, multiple law changes, multiple contract changes. I got started in the dot-com bust. That's when I cut my teeth in real estate investing.
Yeah.
I've invested through the Great Recession. I've invested through that credit boom right before that. I've invested through the last 10 years, which has been the best 10 years ever. I've invested through a pandemic. I've invested through hurricanes, tornadoes, ice storms, snowstorms. You're in California, so I haven't invested through not on wood. I don't have to.
No one can get insurance anymore anyway, so I don't recommend it. Yeah.
So a little about my journey.
Yeah. You've invested in down markets. You've invested in great markets. I would say, what are some of the lessons that you've learned, not necessarily that were correlated to the market, but just in general, what were some like hard, maybe lessons you learned the hard way or some fails that you had to show that it wasn't always, I feel like people get this idea that it's, oh, I went from one house under contract to a multifamily of 200 overnight. And it's this grand success because that's all we see on social media. We don't really see the valleys people went through and, you know, what they maintained to get to where they are. So tell us about some hits you took or some losses.
Yeah, sure. When we first started investing, because what's interesting is my first loan was about the same interest rate as the loans that they are giving out today. And sometimes I feel like I'm let them eat cake. And I have to realize that it's perspective, right? For me, it's, yeah, no, I've been through this. It's all good. But for someone who's not a full cycle investor, it can unhinge you, right? It can cause a lot of trouble and frustration. For me, one of the things that a colleague of mine taught me very early on was that my job as an entrepreneur is to look for the disruption in the marketplace and come up with a solution for that disruption, put a process and system around it, hand it to somebody else to do for you while you're looking and working on the next disruption. And so for us, getting started in the dot-com bust and working in a community where there was a lot of tech, so we're in the part of Texas that's like the sister Silicon Valley, and A lot of the first deals that I did were short sales, right? So I found all of these people were having some decrease in income and or increase in expense, getting laid off. And so I did a ton of short sales. And at the time when I got started, banks were doing their job, which was lending, right? And 2009, 10, 11, we got to do more short sales again. But the banks stopped doing their job, which was lending. So I had a seller who was a motivated seller. I had a buyer who was a motivated buyer, but I didn't have the glue in the middle, which was the bank who was putting the haves and wants together. So for a long time, hit my head against the wall. So I just thought, oh, this is easy. I got this. I'm just going to work hard, right? This is just part of my DNA. And it was all I was doing is just hitting my head. It's like I had all of these short sales and then I didn't have any buyers for them. So at some point I realized that the disruption is not that there's not sellers because there are a ton of sellers, not that there are not buyers because there are a ton of buyers, but the glue in the middle. So probably it took me about 6 months before I was able to pull myself away from that old thinking and then put myself in today's times thinking and be able to come up with a solution. So where I was basically wrapping it, getting a property subject to that normally an investor wouldn't touch, meaning a seller with little, no, or negative equity, and finding a buyer who didn't care about the equity position, just cared that they could get the house. Yeah. And maybe a lender or a borrower who couldn't get a traditional loan just because of a credit score, because of past hiccup, but had the money, had the down payment. And as you get this willing seller, you get this willing buyer. And through the magic of subject to and a wraparound mortgage and having the skill set to do that, I got to take part in some of that buyer's down payment. And the seller was thrilled and relieved because number one, they didn't have to do a short sale. Number two, they didn't have to lose their property to foreclosure. But it took us a while to realize that, hey, this is what we're going to have to do to be able to survive what was probably the longest great recession that we've ever lived through, right? A normal recession is usually only about 2 years, right? If you look, 2008 was it, we didn't get out of it for most markets until January of 2012, right? So that was about 3.5 years, 4 years. And then during that timeframe, just because the market took a 30% haircut in terms of the number of sales, there was an asset. I can't even tell you I don't even want to mention the name of the street because it makes my little heart break, but it was an asset that we had to sell. And if we had held on to it for another 5-6 years, we probably could have sold it for double what we sold it for and probably could have made an extra $1 million on it. So that was a little heartbreaking. As I mentioned earlier, it's like cash is king. We had to keep the cash coming in to stay liquid for all of the other things that were going on in that market. And so that taught me is to be able to survive a recession, even if it is uncomfortable. You're looking at a lot of cash in your bank, especially when it's a high inflationary environment, that cash is going to make sure that you service your debt, make sure that you don't have to sell anything that you don't want to sell, and also give you the ability to be nimble in a market where great opportunities come up, which are down markets, right? Yeah. And for me, knowing that the average recession is only 2 years long, and I can't even say that we're in a recession right now. Just if you look at unemployment numbers, they're still so high. If you look at job creation, it's still so high.
Yeah. And the people that are getting hit with with layoffs, it's that tech industry, but that's a byproduct of them spending outside their means because money was so cheap. Definitely. So it's not as a whole. Yeah. The jobs don't look that bad. It's that one industry, which I think people see that because they see, oh my gosh, Facebook, oh my gosh, these big companies are laying off, but it's because the money was so cheap for them to raise that they didn't really plan ahead for this possibility of this happening. So I agree with you. I think that we are headed there, I think, but I don't think we're there yet.
Yeah, I agree. It's going to be one of the weirdest recessions we've ever had. 2008 had all the markings of a typical recession, but 2022, 2023, it doesn't, right? So number one mark is reduction in employment or unemployment going up. I want to say it was in the 9 to 10% range in 2008-9 versus right now, I think it's 3.7%. And that's just like the government calls full employment and an unemployment rate that's below 6%. So technically we're still fully employed. But the housing market is definitely correcting, right? In Texas, for example, for most of the markets, we've had a 30% year-over-year haircut in the total number of sales. Now, our average price in Texas is still up somewhere between 5 to 8%, depending on the market. I was just doing the math earlier. We've had gone from a 3% interest rate to a 7% interest rate. So we've gone up four points in interest rates.
I think the prices would have come down more.
They're not because of supply. Yeah. And so I was doing the calculations like, okay, for every 1% increase in interest rates, it's a 7.5% drop in total sales. So we're up 4 interest rate percentages and our sales are down 30%. So if Jerome Powell, I know he said he's going into the market now to, or the next increase is probably only going to be 0.5%, but then the next one after that will also probably be 0.5%. So another 1% might take our sales down 37.5% over the next year over year. And a 2% total increase, so going from 7 to 9, could get us down 45% year over year. 30% down year over year was exactly where we were from our height to our trough in the Great Recession. So we're already there in terms of reduction number of sales. And I think it's probably going to go lower, but the sales prices are still up just because of inventory, right? It's basic supply and demand. Now, I will say one of the tips for a downturn that you need to watch out for as a new investor is don't just look at days on market. Days on market are the time on market for the lucky ones that actually make it to the finish line. Look at months of inventory instead, because months of inventory really represents your full liability as in terms of holding time for a real estate investor. And what's a little scary about most months of inventory stats, it's because of the distribution of real estate sales, right? Winter, spring, summer, fall, winter again. It goes back a full year. So we always compare year over year versus month over month. But because months of inventory takes a look at the total sales over the last year, it's pulling in sales when we were at the fever pitch all the way up through May of 2022. So months of inventory, when the market's going down, is actually looks lower than what it actually is. So it's really actually higher than that. So that can be really scary if you're looking at $1 million investment where, okay, holding time days on market might only be 60 days, but your total competition, if you calculate all that in using months of inventory, it might be 6 months, it might be 9 months. And that's why I said having that liquidity is really key right now, because the way the markets go up is it takes the escalator up, but it takes the elevator down. Right? So it goes down at twice the rate that it goes up, which can be really scary. Is there's almost, okay, what price do I have to price it at to be able to sell? There may not be that bottom price. And what we're seeing a lot of people transition to, which is we're in a much better state than where we were. For example, in 2008, where interest rates were 7%, all of the people who refinance in 2020, 2021, 2022, they can afford to sit on these houses and keep them as rental properties and they're cash flowing, right? Versus in 2008, 9, 10, 11, it's like there were adjustable rate mortgages, there were balloon notes, then monthly mortgage payments were above rent rate. So there were losing cash flow, which for a lot of people is can't take that at all. And so they had to sell at the bottom of the market or short sale or foreclose or whatever it may be. Those are some of the things that I think smart investors should be watching out for, especially in this market when, again, you're taking the elevator down. So it feels like it's happening very quickly. It's Ernest Hemingway, it's this book, The Sun Also Rises. And he was asking one of the characters in the book, how did you go bankrupt? And the guy said, gradually, then all of a sudden. What happened? Again, those escalator up and the elevator down. So you have to really be forecasting, really good at forecasting your future cash flows in a market like what we're in right now.
Yeah. And I think something you pointed out is this is a very different type of recession that we're heading into than 2008, where people, like you said, they've refinanced, they had tons of equity in their home when they refinanced. So typically they're probably going to be able to afford those mortgages and sit on them. I just thought that was a really good point that you made. And
they're wearing, it's like all of these people who refinance in 2020, 2021, 2022, they're wearing kind of these invisible golden handcuffs because they really can't sell their house and do anything other than maybe make a lateral move unless they're saving another several hundred thousand dollars to be able to put down. So that is probably one of the biggest saving graces. There's two really, I think, that are out there that's going to really help the housing market have a softer landing. Number one, again, we have all of these homeowners that maybe would like to sell, but don't have to, and then can alternatively rent and don't want to sell these properties because of these golden handcuffs of these rates. Yeah. And the second thing that I think has really helped us, it's builders. And I think it's probably even more than builders as it is the availability of data. And so that's Moore's Law, that's technology. I don't think a lot of builders were looking at months of inventory in 2008, 9, and 10, right? Yeah. And it's like, we've started this, so we're building it, versus builders today have more data to be able to see what are the total permits, right? What's coming on board, and should I or should I not be building? And I think they got so hurt in 2008, 9, and 10 that they were gun shy already. And the other kind of saving grace at the same time is just the lack of labor, right? So I think builders would have way overbuilt if even had the labor to be able to do that. But luckily, in a way, it was not having the labor that partially caused that market to go up, and also those very low interest rates. But now that's one of the things that I think has saved a lot of builders, in my opinion.
Yeah. Looking at where we are today, what specific market opportunities do you see for someone who's, I have cash, real estate is something I'm interested in. I don't know a bunch about it, but I know that's how people make money, long-term generational wealth. I want to get started. Are there any like specific asset classes, markets, like specifically that you're like, that's where I have my eyes on?
For me, when again, we're in the elevator that's going down, you either want to get in projects that you can get in and out of really quickly. You want to be in projects that are much longer, so you can be on the upside of that curve. So meaning projects that are, you're in and out in less than 6 months, or projects that you are in for at least, for example, 2 years, which is just looking forward, the average recession is about 2 years long, right? So you have to be able to hold on to those things. And when we saw a lot of what I'll call dental landlords in 2007, 8, and 9, I can't really sell it unless I bring money to the table, unless I do a short sale. So I'm just going to keep it. I think we're going to have a lot of accidental landlords who were investors, who are fix and flip investors today. So I will say, be nimble in your financing. Make sure that you have financing options and you know what those are. Yeah. If you're borrowing from a hard money lender, typically they want their money back in 6 months. And typically they'll do one or two extensions, which might give you 1 to 6 months, depending on how long those extensions are. But you really need to be exploring bridge financing. You really need to be exploring whether you can get capital, again, to this long-term capital so that you can hold it. So I will say, just in general, any mistake that you make on the buy by overpaying or going into a market where it's taking the elevator down, it can be remedied by, again, time and appreciation. You just have to have that cash flow to be able to support that. I was reading in the Wall Street Journal this past weekend, this hashtag Airbnb bust. So they said that a lot of people who have Airbnb, so the number of Airbnb bookings are higher than they've ever been. But the problem is the supply is also higher than it's ever been. So the result is this delta that on average, most people have a 6% reduction. And that's assuming at this higher level, have a 6% reduction from what their bookings were last year. But the truth is, when your bookings were here last year, as an example, because your inventory or your bookings were here and your inventory was here, my hands may not be doing the right thing as I'm looking at my reflection, but it may feel like to you like a much bigger hit than a 6% hit, just because that 6% over every property, even the new property that's been out there. I'm seeing so many people just get on that bandwagon. I left the station a long time ago, and sometimes when you get into these situations, it's you made a bad decision 6 months ago, but you're not going to find that out until another 6 months. I would say, like, the people who are looking at Airbnb, that's awesome, but make sure that your property can cash flow on a worst case scenario, which to me, what a worst case scenario looks like is you're just buying it and holding it as a regular rental property if you can't get the bookings. So those are some things that, some kind of trends I'm seeing and some of the trends that I'm reading about. But I think you're in California, I'm in Texas. We have so many people from California migrating to Texas.
And you're in Austin, right?
I'm in Austin.
Yeah, I have literally tons of people from my area who moved out. One of the companies I used to work for put an office there. Yeah, I'm sure Texas is still booming.
Book that I have behind me. It's called Upside, Profiting from the Profound Demographic Shifts Ahead by Kenneth Groenbeck. And one of the things that he said in here is that taxes don't redistribute income. Taxes redistribute people. Think about that, right? So we're seeing a big redistribution from high tax states to low tax states. And I think, so I will say, being in Texas, we have a ton of people relocating here from other high tax states. So I think, and even just if you go back to the last session, Texas did really well relative to many of the other large states. So our average sales price was basically flat, took a little dip, but was basically flat over those 4 years. Versus if you look at California, Florida, Arizona, or Nevada, took a 30% plus dip, right? In places like that, the variation, right? The highs, it is like one of, it's the above 18-year-old roller coaster. Versus if you look at the variation in Texas, it's much tighter, right? So it's this range. So it's like the, you can put grandma on this roller coaster, or you can put your kids on this roller coaster, but you wouldn't want to put them on maybe. And I hope this comes here. I know you've got so many folks that are in California. That is the reality of it, right? Yeah. And I mean, California is a beautiful place.
The highs are high and the lows are low.
Yes. Yeah.
But to play devil's advocate, wouldn't you say that there's more opportunity then to get in on the low in California and make a bigger ride at high?
Absolutely. The trouble is any market, you can't time the market. But again, as long as you stay in it long enough, you might sell here and it's still going to here, or you might sell here after it was there. I'll tell you a funny story. When we first started investing and buying and holding property, we went to the top property manager in town. And we said, hey, where should we be buying rental property? You've been doing this for 25 years. We're just getting started. Like, you've got
that in and of itself is a great tip for people. So anyways, continue.
So we went to this top property manager and they said, oh, you need to be buying, this is Austin, for example, you need to be buying rental properties out here in the suburbs of Austin. And I said, wow, really? Why should we? I don't think that was a great area, but why? Tell me why we should be buying there. Yeah. And the property manager said, because that's where all the rental properties are. And it's, okay, is there logic in that? I don't know. Because like when you're around a whole bunch of rental properties, values are typically going down as opposed to going up. Like for me, I always thought I want to be the only rental property in an area of homeowners and they're all improving their property. And I'm probably the one that looks bad out of all of them in there. And we were asking, continuing to talk to him, and he was getting a little flustered, annoyed with us at this point. But we'd asked him what appreciation in this area that's a suburb of a suburb, if you will. And he got a little flustered. And then he said, I guess if you're looking for that California style appreciation, you're not going to find it here. And Phil was like, aren't we all looking for that California? What are you thinking? Thank God we didn't take his advice. What's worse than trusted advice? Trusted advice from a bad source, right? So that was one of those things where it's like, he was good at maximizing his business, which was managing rental property for owners, but he was not also an owner himself owning these properties and seeing, because for all of us, we have the cost of capital, but then we have this thing called our opportunity cost of capital, right? So we could have bought in that neighborhood where values were going up like this, or we could have bought in a different neighborhood where values were going up like this. And the thing is, because of compound interest, right? Over time, right at the end of that's when the values really start to make the big difference between investing in something that's having an average 6% return versus something that's maybe having an above average 10 or 15% return. That compounding over time is really where you need to be, really make beautiful choices in terms of the ones that you keep, the ones that are going to build your wealth versus the ones that you say, nope, this is one I'm in and out of very quickly. Do you follow?
Yeah, no, that's good advice. It comes down to, like you said, like the timing, how long are you going to stay in something? Why would you stay in something longer? And being able to walk through that thought process. So I'm curious, you lead your association in Texas and you have a huge group. I was in Texas when we met and everyone knows Shanoa. You're in Texas and you don't know her. I'm like, who are you? So tell me a little bit about that and how people become a part of that and what you cover at these things, because I'm sure we have people listening in from all over. So I always like to, if people are local to where people were speaking from, then.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So we have meetings in Austin, Houston, Dallas, and San Antonio every month. You can find us by going to TexasREIAS, REIAS.com. REIA stands for Real Estate Investor Association. So it's REIAS plural, just because we have several of them. So we meet live every month. We do a coaching tip. So if someone's just getting started or someone's struggling, I actually bring them up to the microphone and I do some live coaching there, which is always fun for me because I never know what they're going to say. But I know that after doing this for about 20 years, I'm probably going to be able to direct them in the right way. And then we do a tip of the week every single week. For example, what's going on in the market, what to be doing. Some of the things that we talked about here as well. Every week we do a market update. So we talk about the different major markets in Texas, how they performed last month and what the forecast is for the rest of the year. And then we do a training session on one of the different strategies that we've used to be able to stay unemployable for the last almost 2 decades. And that's our core meeting, our kind of introductory meeting. And yeah. then after that, people will come to a 3-day training with to be able to really get down into all of the different things that we've learned throughout our investing journey and figure out how they can use that as well. And then some people decide after that, hey, I have a little more hand holding from someone who's been doing this and been able to survive and thrive, a full cycle investor, made it through all the different market cycles.
Yeah.
And so some of them will go on to do individual coaching and mentoring with myself, my husband, and the rest of our coaching team as well. And what I find is a lot of people who are interested in investing in Texas, both who some of the ones who live here, they'll get attracted like by some of these national speakers and stuff. And it's they can give you this super high level knowledge. But when it comes down to, I need the name of a contractor. I need the name of a plumber, of an electrician. I need to know who can give me access to the comps. I need to know who, where to close at. I need to know where I can get the contracts from. You have to get that from local sources, right? So a lot of these national companies will say, I don't know the answer to that. Go to your local REITs. Okay, I'm glad you found us. Sorry you had to go through all that other stuff to get here. We are often that stop for people where it's, okay, now I found a place that has everything that I need, that has the tribal knowledge, and is willing to share that tribal knowledge with the rest of the group. When I first started investing, as you mentioned, I joined the local real estate investor association and I later bought it. So I joined it in 2003. I bought it in 2008. But the rest of that story was I was a 5-year volunteer at that association. And I volunteered and they asked me to volunteer because they could tell like left brain, organized, analytical, okay, have her help in some way. And I got to know everyone in the group. So I got to know who had deals. I got to know who had money. I got to know who was real. I get to know who was not. I got to know who had the power team. I got to know who had the strategies. I got to know the right contractors, the right attorneys, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And so I'll tell you the first deal that I did after that one, when I was in my 20s with my mom, the first deal I did when I got restarted was I got a deal from someone in that group. And the last deal I got from someone who was part of that group, right? So this is a group that throws off money, that throws off deals, that throws off partners, that throws off just all of the power team members and really, and just the thinking, that tribal knowledge in order to, that shared in order to be successful and be able to grow. Love this group. I continue to carry the torch today, not because I have to, but because it's served me so well. And it is truly a great place to be able to get that real, those local, ethical, educated boots on the ground investors from people who have been doing it, as opposed to someone who comes in for one day and then you never see them again. I always joke with the members of the association, you're going to see me again, whether you want to or not, because this is my baby. This is the foundation of my success. And I know it's the foundation of so many other people's success as well. So
I think that power of networking, we have a whole podcast on this. You purchased this REIA in 2008. Like, what did you inherit and how did you make that grow? What was your key to success in growing that?
It's interesting because the woman who owned it before me,
that it was another woman.
Yeah, Angelique. She got very busy in her personal life and I think had fallen out of love with it. After the first 2 or 3 years, I didn't really even see her at the meetings anymore. So I was actually had been running the thing as if it were my own. So I took extreme ownership of that thing and would just drop off the checks over at her house. And it helped me cut my teeth on my presentation skills. It helped me cut my teeth on my network and just really building out my entire business. So I was already running it before she said, hey, I'm going to just totally do something else. And she asked me if I wanted to buy it. And it was, since I had already been operating it for almost 5 years before, it was just like, it was just a make versus buy decision. So I could have remade it. I had the list, all of the members, but it already had presence. It already had kind of an online networking form, right, that we were using. So it already had a couple of things that were part of it that we had also grown over that time. So it just made sense. It wasn't a large amount of money, but we took it and we just used that same kind of those same foundational pieces to be able to build it into the other cities and grow networks all throughout Texas. Yeah, I'd say it was the foundation of my success as a real estate investor. And I think for many, that's where they get their footing, right? That's where they get that tribal knowledge, which I think is in a world where the internet knows everything, right? You can get anything in a podcast or a YouTube show.
Yes.
The problem is there's a fair amount of ridiculousness and it's just sprinkled in and you just don't know which way is right. Or you get pieces, you don't get the entire plan. So if you can go a couple of feet forward and then it's like, there's a skip between here and here. So it's like, and now what? Yeah. So we provide a lot of the, and now what? So.
Awesome. Well, and I think something like you mentioned, there's, you can find anything on the internet. Yes. But I think a lot of it comes from people who do not have that full cycle experience, that may have ridden the wave of the last 10 years and gotten super lucky and become these experts, when now we're really going to see who the experts are. We're going to see who can survive the next like 5 years with they have been doing, or if they choose to adjust. So I love that that's something that I feel like probably a lot of people you've been through are real about it. You say it's not just all rainbows and butterflies. If someone was interested in connecting with you or reaching out, how can they find you?
Yeah. TexasReias, REIAS.com. TexasReias, REIAS.com. That's how you can find me and just know where I am, know where we're talking, know where we're presenting. We have obviously, I'd say 90% of our members are in Texas, but we have at least 10% that are in other states who understand the demographics that are creating so much opportunity in Texas that they want to invest here. They want to be diversified here, right? So yeah, no matter where you are, if you're investing in Texas, I can help you. If you're investing in other states, I'm not going to be able to. I'm not
the
one.
I love that.
Stuff, but I can't give you those local boots on the ground. That is, there's a beautiful saying, there are riches and niches, and Texas is my niche.
I love that. It was so great having you on
today. Good to connect with you again. Yeah, good to connect with you again. And thank you so much for having me. So
yeah, of course. Thank you everyone for joining us today on this episode of the CWS podcast. If you enjoyed the show, share it with a friend, subscribe, or leave us a review. Until next time, bye.
Thank you for joining Lauren and I on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. Each week, we bring you expert education, experience, and information in a digestible format to help you identify investment opportunities so you can build wealth through real estate and take action toward your financial goals. Enjoy the show, share with a friend, or subscribe to the show, and leave us a review.